The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast, joining you again this week. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the podcast. We've been bringing you some pretty cool interviews, I think, and ruminating on some seasons past in Milwaukee Brewers history, with of course, no baseball being played during this coronavirus pandemic. And thought I would actually bring in a guest who can speak about two very different seasons in Milwaukee Brewers history. His name is Dale Swaim. Clearly, I'm sure, if you are a fan of Brewers history, you know his name. We did talk about him briefly in the 1987 episode, a couple episodes ago, where I spoke with Brewers beat reporter Tom Haudricourt in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, all about what went on in that 87 season. Haudricourt was with the Milwaukee Sentinel at the time, and actually named the 1987 team Streak. That was something that he had put in print that sort of caught on when, of course, a lot of crazy things happened, and we've talked about them. Juan Nieves' no-hitter, Paul Molitor's hitting streak, Teddy Higuera's scoreless inning streak, starting with 12 wins in a row, or 13 wins in a row, I should say, losing 12 games in a row. Dale Swaim, of course, if you are familiar with the 1987 season, was right in the middle of that. He hit the big game-winning home run on Easter Sunday. He batted ninth that year for the Brewers. He was playing shortstop and was pretty formidable. It was his best year offensively in his playing career, and he wound up having a big role there in the middle of that team streak phenomenon. He also hit three home runs in a game that year, so I wanted to bring him on board to talk about that season. But then also, as I'm sure again that many of you know, in 2008 Dale Swaim was on the coaching staff with the Brewers under coach manager Ned Yost, and became the manager with 12 games to go when Ned Yost was fired. The Brewers went to Philadelphia, famous four-game sweep at the hands of the Phillies, and then had to piece it together the rest of the way under Dale Swaim to get into the playoffs for the first time in 26 years, and that is exactly what they did. Dale Swaim coaching the Brewers back to the playoffs, sort of a strange path to get there, but in 2008... he was the manager when the Milwaukee Brewers snapped that streak. That's a crazy year. CeCe Sabathia, of course, is sort of the headliner in the middle of the season and the latter half of the season. But you had Ryan Braun's big home run in the final day of the season. The Mets collapsing, allowing the Brewers to sneak in there. An absolutely insane final week of the season against the Pittsburgh Pirates and a big sweep at Miller Park. They sweep that series. I believe they won their season finale on Sunday. Series finale on Sunday against the Cincinnati Reds, leading into that final homestand. They sweep the Pirates. They win 2 of 3 against the Cubs and end up with the wild card 90-win season. And so I thought Dale would, you know, want to chat about that too. The 2008 season was several years later, obviously, a totally different ballgame with him in a managerial head coach capacity. And so I thought we'd chat about both seasons. And we will probably come back and talk more about the 2008 season with Tom Haudricourt on a future episode of this podcast. That's a really great season to talk about. This sort of straddles the line between 1987 and 2008. And how appropriate that it comes at a time when my series at jsonline.com has been running the 50 in 50, chronicling the 50 greatest sporting moments in Wisconsin sports history over the past 50 years. We are halfway through now. Number 25 landed at the jsonline.com site on Tuesday, I believe, and then number 24 is coming up on Wednesday. Those are both up there, ready for you to read, and they happen to both touch on each side of this conversation. Juan Nieves' no-hitter is the number 25 moment from 1987, and the team trading for CeCe Sabathia in the middle of the 2008 season is number 24. So go check those out. I've been keeping track of making sort of giving feature treatment to all of these moments as we work our way toward number one. By the time we get there, we're definitely still going to be in these strange times. There still won't be new live sports, so I'm hoping to maybe go back and do maybe 10 more, the next 10, 51 through 60, to sort of flesh out this list even a little bit more. But that's for another day. Right now, apologize for the audio quality. It's not quite as good as normal. Wasn't able to reach Dale under normal means through the software, so he's on just on a cell phone. Should be able to hear him just fine, but apologies if it sounds a little bit different than normally does. And here he is, my conversation with Dale Swaim. My guest is Dale Swaim. You may know him as a Brewers fan in a couple different capacities. He was on the 1987 team streak that we've talked about in past podcasts. Of course, hitting the big walk-off home run on Easter Sunday back in 1987. And he was back with the Brewers on the coaching staff for several years, actually. And perhaps most notably in 2008 when the Brewers went to snap that 26-year playoff drought and made it back to the playoffs. He was there, the interim manager, with 12 games to go in the regular season. I definitely want to talk about that. I want to talk about 87 to begin with. But before we even get to that, I'm kind of curious what you're doing now. My understanding is you're still working in the Royals front office in some capacity. So what are you up to right now?
Yeah, well, obviously no baseball people are doing anything right now. But my official job is just kind of my special assignment scout. Basically what I was doing before with the Royals. I was just kind of going to see some of the upper top hitters that were going to be in the draft. Made a few trips around the country during spring training to see a few kids and as well as some of the games and tournaments that were going on here with some college tournaments, ASU games, some high school games here. And then being out in spring training, evaluating our players, our major league players, and then our minor league camp just got on the way before the coronavirus thing hit and everything got shut down. So basically, I kind of do a little bit whatever Dayton or our scouting director might call me up and says, "Hey, I need you to fly here to see this guy or that guy," and kind of doing a little bit of that, but no more being away from the house for 7.5 months. It was just time for me to get away from that and spend more time at home. And I'd been doing it for a long time, and it was just I just thought it was that kind of time and still be able to stay in the game.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thought we would be this close to home for this long, but you got more than you bargained for that way. I want to go back all the way to 1982, which is another memorable year in Brewers history. But if I recall correctly, that is your first year in professional baseball, at rookie ball in the Arizona League. And my understanding was because it was a struggle for you to start your pro career. It was a rough first year, and you had considered taking a scholarship to go play football at Arizona State, which would have completely changed your career trajectory. Do you remember that being a really close call, that you were really seriously thinking about pursuing football instead?
Yeah, I mean, it actually, I did, really. I mean, I ended up, was going to sign my letter of intent all over again to play football at ASU here in Arizona. And, things went a different direction because of my contract. So I needed to play another year to fulfill my contract that I signed, my bonus and all that stuff. And so I ended up sticking it out and playing ball, and obviously the rest is history after that. But yeah, I mean, football was my life growing up in Northern California. So it was kind of out of nowhere that I got drafted in the first round. And to say the least, there was a struggle. Yeah, I went to Pikeville, Kentucky in rookie ball and was probably the worst player in the league, not just on my own team.
That's crazy.
We didn't have a very good team. I think we only won like 25 games in rookie ball. So it was a big struggle. I was just learning how to switch hit and hit from the left side. So it was all a big struggle. But everything obviously ended up working out fine. But there was some kind of turmoil there at the beginning, what I really wanted to do and how I was going to go about it. But it all ended up in the baseball world, and 38 years later I've been in baseball for that many years. So
yeah. And then in 1986, when you're at the big league level, you're playing third base. There isn't an opening at shortstop, obviously, with the Brewers, and you're at third base, and I know that was another struggle, especially defensively. And from what I was reading, it sounds like going into the 87 season, which is a huge year for you, it sounds like you didn't do really anything special in the winter of 86 to 87. In fact, I'd read that you just took the whole year off pretty much, except for like lifting weights here and there. You were just getting away from baseball for a little bit. And obviously that seemed to work because 87 was a crazy year for you. What do you remember from that time?
I don't know where you heard that about taking the winter off. I completely reconstructed my swing.
Oh wow, okay.
To make a long story short, our hitting coach at the time, Tony Muser, because I pulled the ball. That's all I did left-handed. I mean, I became a decent hitter. I think in Double A, I had 185 hits, but I just wasn't driving the ball out of the ballpark. A lot of doubles. I think I had like 40-something doubles in that. And so anyway, I got to the big leagues, and I'm 37 for 100. My first 100 at bats in the big league, so I'm pretty styling at 370 after 100 at bats, but not catching the ball very well at all, which was more of my forte at the time. Catch, make contact, hit the ball, drive the ball, hit the ball in gaps, and that kind of thing. And the second time around, I wasn't getting many fastballs anymore, and I was kind of rolling over. Tony said, you got to learn how to hit the ball at all fields if you're going to be any kind of hitter at this level. So basically I spent that whole winter completely changing my swing almost to a George Brett at that time. I kind of picked a player. I was like, okay, who's probably the best in baseball right now from the left side driving the ball to all fields? And it was George Brett. So I kind of innovated my swing to a little bit of him. I backed off the plate. I kind of started diving into home plate and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, and had a really good year swinging the bat and driving the ball over the fence the opposite way and doing those things. So I definitely did a lot of work in that winter after my rookie season. And then I got, shortstop. I never really played shortstop besides rookie ball in the minor leagues. I played third base. Hmm. And then the next year, I was pretty much slated to be the utility player. Ernie Riles was going to be the shortstop. Of course, Robin moved to the outfield, and Pauly was still at third, and Jimmy was at second. There really wasn't many openings. I mean, I went to instructionally to play center field because I ran really well at the time. But anyway, Ernie Riles messes up his finger in a bar fight and opens up a spot at shortstop, and obviously the rest was history as far as that went. That season I got to play shortstop every day and had a heck of a year.
Yeah, I was trusting some old Journal Sentinel articles there that had quoted, but maybe I misread it, because obviously that was a huge turning point for you, the offseason of 86 into 87. 25 home runs in 1987. Obviously, I want to talk about Easter Sunday, but that whole season is ridiculous, and we've gone over it. I think everybody kind of knows all the highlights. I know you had a three-homer game, which we don't even talk about in the course of 87 because of so much else that went on, but three home runs in one game was a big moment, too. Just in general, from 1987, when you think about that year, I mean, I assume it sticks out as a season that was different from a lot of others, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. And if that's the case, what are one or two things that you really think about, aside from Easter Sunday, that really sort of resonate, like, man, 1987, I really remember this?
Well, I think the one thing I remember as much as, obviously, the home run on Easter Sunday and all the personal things and all the other personal things that a lot of our players went through. Pauly's hitting streak, Robin's, I forget what Robin's streak was. He had something going on too. I forget what it was. I don't know if it was home runs or streak or something like that. But anyway, and Teddy Higuera's, I think 40 something innings in a row. But I think the biggest thing I remember more than anything, because it was such a special team year that, there wasn't a wild card that year, or because I really believe we might have been the best team in all of baseball, that to finish in that season, because people forget that, we started 13-0, 20-3, then we lost 13 in a row, and at the All-Star break, I believe we were two games under 500.
You were,
and
yes.
Ended up winning 91 games, I think. We had an incredible second half, and we were some kind of rolling, those last 2 weeks of the season. And so I think there's always one thing I regret is never being able to play in the playoffs, and especially play in the playoffs with the Milwaukee Brewers, which obviously who I came up with. And it was an incredible season. But I think I remember that what Twins won the World Series with 86 wins that year. Mm-hmm. And so I think I sit back and I always, you know, the what if we could have got to the playoffs that year was a big thing, because all the other stuff was just incredible. It was just, it seemed like every week, 2 weeks, there was something going on. Obviously, everybody knows, and that's why the team, you know, became Team Street. But on a team thing, but so many young players. I mean, we just had, you know, besides Robin and Paulie and Jimmy Gantner, I mean, our team was just incredibly young. And everybody was doing so well at the time for being either rookies or second year players.
Do you get the sense in the 80s? Right now, we talk a lot when we talk about Major League Baseball about sort of the economic disparity between big market, small market. I would gather that in the 80s and 70s, that's less of an issue. There just isn't a big enough market yet for that to have happened. But did you get the sense that the Brewers are an underdog, that they're the little guy in the small market? And they're obviously competing, winning a bunch of games through the late 70s, early 80s, so they're not struggling by any means. But was it an underdog story in the minds of sort of Milwaukeeans, I guess, at the time?
I think back then, I think you kind of said it. I think back then you didn't really think small market, big market. The New York Yankees was and will always be the juggernaut of baseball or organizations that make tons and tons of money before the first pitch is even thrown. But back then, the Yankees were okay, but then no powerhouse. They were going through times as an organization where they weren't winning World Series or winning divisions or any of that thing on a yearly basis. So everybody was very equal back then, and we had such a strong scouting and minor league system at the time that we were producing pitchers and hitters at a crazy rate, that were having incredible success at the big leagues right away. So we were very competitive, but I don't think, and you know, especially we were very lucky as young players to have, you know, Robin and Paulie and Jimmy Gantner with us at that time, because we learned so much from them. There'll never be, I don't think, three players until this day, I can say, because I've been around a long time. There's never three players that a young player could ever learn more from than those three guys. To this day, Robin's still my best friend, and we still talk about baseball, now we learn from each other. But back then, I mean, I learned so much from Robin and Jimmy Gantner and Paul Molitor about baseball and all assets. I mean, obviously those guys are in the Hall of Fame besides Jimmy, but I mean, base running and little things, and I still use to this day, that still come true, that they were far ahead of the scale. And, you know, myself and BJ Surhoff and Glenn Bragg and Rob Deere you go on and on about that team, how much, we learned from those guys, on and off the field. They're unbelievably professional off the field, as well as hard workers. You know, one thing I'll never forget, Robin told me when I was probably 19 years old, I just came over as a fill-in for a spring training game. You know, he basically said, every time you come to the park, you just try and make yourself a better player. And imagine you're in game 7 of the World Series in the 9th inning, and you're not going to be embarrassed by any situation. If you got to get a sacrifice bunt down, if you have to hit run, if you have to steal a base, anything, don't ever be caught off guard. And you better be, as good as you possibly can at all of those assets. So you don't be embarrassed in game 7 of a World Series. So you always make yourself a better player every single day you walk on that field.
There are so many aspects to this Easter Sunday game, and we've talked about them on this podcast before. There's Tom Hodricourt told the story of the Easter egg hunt that took place before the game that kind of went down in infamy. There's Bobby Valentine, the Rangers manager, saying he's not impressed with what the Brewers had done to that point when they had won 11 straight games. Taking out Mitch Williams, who had pitched very well, young left-hander at the time, kind of had an electric arm. and that sort of take him out to face Rob Deere, bring in Greg Harris, and then Rob Deere hits a curveball into outer space. I mean, just tattoos a ball that, of course, ties the game. In that moment, at that time, you're still three batters away from coming to the plate yourself, but do you remember what it was like seeing Rob Deere's home run leave, or what you were feeling in that ninth inning? I mean, did you feel like the streak was over at that point? Because, you know, you'd had a good run. You were down three runs into the ninth. It had to cross everybody's mind. Yeah, okay, this is probably where it ends. I don't know. Give me a sense.
Well, I think what happened, as much as anything, is yeah, you can have hindsight and say, yeah, we're going to come back and win this game. you know, but I think when we left the field after the top of the ninth and whatever it was, I think there was probably close to 30,000 people, whatever there was, you know, they stood and cheered and kind of got us going, because we didn't, I think maybe Guzman started for them or mm-hmm. something. It was a really good young pitcher back there. Can't remember all the details, but, you know, we really didn't do much offensively at all day long. And then, of course, Mitch came in, and I think about the seventh inning, and really shut the door. It was probably the most strikes Mitch has ever thrown in his life in a two and a half inning stint, whatever he ended up throwing.
He was so good, and he's remembered for giving up Joe Carter.
Relief, I think when you know, Valentine took him out of the game and bring in, you know, Greg Harris, who was basically just a curveball guy, threw maybe 90 miles an hour with a cutter, you know, but nothing overpowering, because the shadows have came in now, which makes it very difficult to hit velocity. And you know, when he bring him in, and obviously Robbie swung at the first curveball and probably almost broke three vertebrae in his back, and then he came back with another strike curveball, and Robbie obviously, it would have probably went out of the stadium if the wind wasn't blowing so hard in mm-hmm. in that day. I think he hit it three quarters of the way up the bleacher. So, and then obviously at that point, you know, now once he hits a home run, we're going to win the game. But we needed to get a guy on base, and you know, we did that. And then obviously Robbie hits a home run, and then Jimmy walks, and then I hit the home run to win the game. But yeah, I think the fans at the point were probably the biggest help to that day of winning anything. Like I said, when we came off the field after the top of the ninth, and 13th game of the year, you got a regular baseball game going on, and that many people stand. It was like almost a playoff atmosphere.
Yeah, you got a high pitch and ambushed it, and I know a lot of Brewers fans are familiar with the replay, probably more so now than ever, because we've been seeing it. Well, actually, that particular game we have not seen on Fox Sports Wisconsin locally, but just there's a lot of classic baseball around. They unearthed the final three innings of that game on MLB.com, so we've been watching it. Have you had a chance? I'm sure you've seen it more than once, but do you find yourself sort of revisiting it ever so often for family members or whatever, or are you not the type of guy to go back and watch that moment in time?
No, I mean, I think that time of year, I think when Easter comes around, I think there's, you know, all the people I've, friends I have in Milwaukee and you know, the clubhouse kids and all that, you know, I've spent a lot of time with over the years. It's kind of almost a standing joke that they're always sending me things about Easter Sunday and showing that video and all that. And so, yeah, I mean, you end up watching it. You relive it. You know, you relive it a lot for, you know, the Rob Deere's home run, you know, I think was so exciting at the time, and to see how we were, you know, rounded the bases and how excited the fans were, you know, going through, you know, that how the TV coverage covered, especially the fans and the bleachers, because it was a beautiful day. Guys had their shirts off. I mean, it was just a phenomenal Easter Sunday for April, whatever it was, April, middle of April. So yeah, you definitely go back and relive it. And there's nothing like listening to you call the game on the radio, like Bob Uecker can, and make calls like he can. And I think those are the things you look back on is the memories of, you know, Bob Uecker making those home run calls.
Did you know that pitch was coming? Because you just said Greg Harris is a curveball guy. He throws one up in the zone and you just tattoo it. You must have had some idea what he was going to throw there.
Well, I mean, the count got to 3-2, and he throws a 3-2 kind of a backdoor cutter, and I fouled it off, and then I was just looking for another cutter on the backdoor part of the plate, because he didn't want me to pull the ball for a home run, so I thought he was going to, his forte was to throw a strike. I was probably going to get a cutter at some point of the plate, and I think he wanted to throw it to the backdoor part of the plate, and he just got left it up right down the middle of the plate, and I jumped on it and obviously hit it out of the ballpark.
Just for personal highlights in your career, I'm sure that's at the top, near the top, whatever, but anything else, maybe other there's that three home run game later in the same season or some of the defensive plays you made. I mean, what's on your personal highlight reel as you look back at your playing career?
Obviously that and the three home run game was to hit three home runs in one game, two left-handed and one right-handed. Will always be special. I had a few more, I think maybe three, four, or five more home run games. And being able to hit home runs from both sides of the plate. Moving on, there were some in Pittsburgh, had some good moments there. Trying to resurrect my career after I had broken my leg and missed a couple seasons of playing, or right in my prime. First time I got to play on a decent everyday basis. I think I had 350 at bats that year in Pittsburgh and had a nice year. But playing wise, a lot of it's mostly wrapped up in that 87 season because of all kinds of stuff, obviously. But me personally, that was obviously my best year. Yeah. And the only year I got to play every day, because the next year, I shattered my leg.
Right.
And, missed all of 89 and probably could have missed most of all of 90 too. But was out there on enough pain medicine and everything like that just to get in the lineup every day or play. I didn't play a whole lot.
Yeah.
Until 91. But I mean, to this day, my leg is still smaller than my right leg because I spent so many months in a full cast. So that was, just bad timing. But, the what ifs, what my career could have been if I didn't shatter my leg is always going to be something that hangs over you.
Yeah.
I was so young at the time.
I've never seen footage of that collision with Darrell Hamilton. That was just a pop up or something like that?
Yeah, just a pop up in Detroit on the left field line. I was playing short. It was actually Darrell Hamilton's first inning in the big leagues. It was September 3rd, and it was actually Gary Sheffield's first inning. He took over at shortstop when I broke my leg. I always give Gary a bad time when I see him. I say, if I never broke my leg, you ain't never freaking mounted to nothing.
It's a Wally Pitt moment.
But, it was just a pop up, and I'm running full speed for it. Nobody could call it. It was just a no man's land down by the bullpen, and I reached out kind of in a stumble and caught it on the backhand, and Darrell just kind of knew he wasn't going to get there, so he went into a slide, and my left shin hit him in the knee and just snapped everything, my tibia, and just turned into a big mess. Yeah. But that's kind of how that all went down.
I think Brewers fans who associate you with the franchise would maybe be surprised to discover or just sort of relearn that you've got three World Series rings with three different organizations, playing with the Yankees and then coaching with the Red Sox before your time with the Brewers and then again with the Royals, of course, afterwards. The Red Sox won that World Series in 2004, and you came over to the Brewers coaching staff under Ned Yost. Ned's playing days and yours don't overlap, but you must have been friends with him. You must have known him a little bit for him to bring you over to Milwaukee from Boston, right? Or how did that relationship?
No, I didn't know Ned at all. He had already been gone by the time I got to big league camp,
right?
With the Brewers, which I believe was probably 85 was my first big league camp, or 86. I'm not real sure, but no, he was gone. I didn't know Ned at all. Robin had called Robin and wanted Robin to coach on the staff, and Robin was okay with it, except he had one caveat that, yeah, if I'm going to coach, then, you know, I need Dale to be here too. So, make a long story short, Robin called and blah, 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 and I just asked the, you know, Red Sox, Theo, if I could have permission to talk to the Brewers about the coaching and to train in Arizona. There was a few things involved. I mean, my kids were at an age where I needed to be a little bit, trying to be home more. Milwaukee's obviously closer. Milwaukee's obviously the team I came up with. Love Milwaukee, love the fans, always love being there. And Theo was nice enough to understand. So anyway, me and Robin ended up on the coaching staff in 2006.
And 2008 then is sort of, it's sort of similar to 87 in that there are a lot of flashpoints. You know, the ending is the one that everyone remembers, much like I think Easter Sunday is the one everyone remembers from 87. But getting CC Sabathia in the middle of the season is sort of the second biggest memory, I guess. What do you remember from that time, either his first game or just having him on the team, having him, you know, work down the stretch every few days? Like, what was the takeaway that really resonates with you during the sort of middle part of that 2008 season?
Well, I think, when we made that trade, you know, we had a good team. We had a good nucleus of young players, obviously Prince and JJ and Corey and, Ricky Weeks, and you know, we had a really good offense, and our pitching was probably average at that time. With Ben Sheets as our number one guy, and the Dave Bushes, and we had a decent bullpen. But once Doug Melvin went out and got CeCe, I think it changed the whole atmosphere in the clubhouse. We had Mike Cameron's veteran guys. Well, you know, what a great guy Mike Cameron was, mm-hmm. As well. But once we got CeCe, and then obviously it wasn't just getting him because everybody knows that was probably, I think he had 17 starts. It could have been possibly the greatest 17 starts a major league pitcher has ever had. One team, especially in a home run hitting ballpark like Milwaukee is, to put the numbers up that he did on an every start. It was like he either didn't give up a run or he gave up one or he might have gave up two. To keep, anytime you have a guy like that and you know when he starts you're going to win the game, just give him two runs. I mean, that's basically what it was. And that was one of our problems down the stretch. Is obviously we had the best offense in baseball for 5 months, and then for some reason we just stopped swinging the bats in September. But CeCe kept us in it. You know, Ben Sheets was really coming back and now pitching really well himself. So we had a 1-2 combination there moving into the final stretch there. And obviously, unfortunately, you know, they let Ned go, and I took over as interim manager, and, you know, CeCe still started dominating, but we still weren't scoring many runs. I mean, the first night CeCe pitched that I managed, I think we lost to the Cubs 2-1. Mm-hmm. He pitched a heck of a game, and I think we lost 2-1, something like that. Then the next night, Ben Sheets blows out in the first inning, blows his elbow out in the first inning. And we luckily win that game. I think I threw a different guy in every inning the rest of the way, the next eight innings, and we won that game 4-0. And then the third game, we were winning, I think, 3-0 or 4-1 or something like that in the ninth inning, and we coughed that game up. Mm-hmm. So my first three games were 1-2, and heading to Cincinnati, and then we got blown out in Cincinnati, so we're 1-3. Yeah. To start that, and then we win two, and then we get back home for the last seven games against Pittsburgh, and we ended up scoring hardly any runs. But Bronny hit a walk-off grand slam. Prince hit a walk-off home run against Pittsburgh. I think we swept them. And then the Cubs came in, and we had to win basically two out of three, I believe, to have a chance at tying. And, you know, we ended up, CC had the ball the last game. And I think he was at like 115 pitches on 3 days rest going into the last inning. And, Mike Maddox, my pitching coach, was like, hey, we got to get Solomon Torres in the game. Because Bronny just hit the home run in the bottom of the eighth to take the lead. And I'm like, I just can't see it. It's hard to take CC out of this game, no matter what. And I think he got a quick out, and he's probably at about 117, 18 pitches, and I think somebody gets on. So we got one out, man on, and he's at about 120, low 20s, and you go, okay, this is the last hitter, and I got that out of my mouth, and Derek Lee hit a missile one hopper right at Durham, and Durham turned it, and I gave it to JJ and turned the double play, and we ended up winning the game. So, yeah. But yeah, it was an exciting time for Milwaukee. Obviously we had to wait about a few innings of the Mets game to get over it and celebrate going to the playoffs for the first time in whatever it was, 25 years, yeah, 26 years, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a phenomenal finish to a season, and what a way to finish at home, and 50,000 people in the stands, and then got to watch the end of the Mets game, and thought David Wright hit a freaking home run that last so swing of the game, and it was like, I think our hearts all freaking caved in, but the guy caught it at the warning track, and then that was it, and we got to go to the playoffs and celebrate.
Yeah, I remember that last swing by David Wright very well, thinking the same thing, thinking, oh my God, after all this, that is going to be gone. So a flashback, I will come back to that season finale, but with 12 games to go, there's that infamous series in Philadelphia where the Brewers get swept, and it's after that Ned Yost is let go. Did you see this coming as a possibility that you would wind up in that, in the managerial seat with so little of the season left? And how were those 12 days for you? Because on the one hand, I imagine it's kind of stressful. It's kind of a job audition. And, for you, I'm sure wants to manage beyond just 12 games. And also, there isn't like a lot of time to be stressed out because, day to day, every game is mattering here. So is it a whirlwind for you? Or you just articulated every game, so you remember.
Yeah, it was crazy because nobody ever thought a manager would be let go. I think we're exactly tied for the wild card after that series in Philadelphia. Well, obviously, they won the World Series, and they overmatched us for four games. They just beat us up really bad those four games. And I think that was a split doubleheader that last day in Philadelphia. And we were going to Chicago and with a day off. So, no, I mean, there was nothing except, getting a phone call in my hotel room the next morning at about 10 in the morning or 9 in the morning. I'm not sure. And we got in. I think we got to our hotel rooms at about 4 in the morning. And, it was Doug Melvin and just says, hey, I need you to come up to my room. And at that time, okay, I'll be right up. And it was mainly like, okay, the whole coaching staff's going to be up there. And, we're either going to get blown up here by our general manager or just kind of ease things going into the season. And I walk in and it was Doug and Mr. Antanasio make a long story short, they said they let Ned go and they want me to be the interim manager. And basically it was, wow. It was like, you talk about a wake-up call in the morning after arriving at 4 o'clock in the morning to Chicago. So, and then after that, it was just basically, I got to find a coaching staff or obviously to fill my spot and one more. So right away I got on the phone and called Robin to see if Robin wanted to finish out the season. And he agreed, and he was there on the next flight out of Phoenix. And then we had that day off to kind of get everybody together and regroup the coaching staff and all that. And then, start the next day, against the Cubs with CC on the mound. So Yeah, it was a complete whirlwind. And then to answer your question, no, I don't think anybody in their right mind would have saw any kind of firing of the manager at that point. I don't think it'll ever happen again, and it probably never happened up to that point. There were 12 games left, and you're tied for a playoff spot that the manager gets let go.
Yeah. I think you may have answered this question, but I wanted to give you a chance to brag a little if there had been a button you pushed, because every game mattered down the stretch. Obviously, every win plays into the Brewers getting to the playoffs. Maybe it was leaving CeCe Sabathia in there on that for that final out. Was there anything you did differently or any decision you made that led to a win, and it could have gone a completely different direction if you hadn't made the call? Anything come to mind?
I don't think so. I think we had a special group of players that we were on the cusp in 2007 of winning. Getting to the playoffs, mm-hmm. We were pretty close. And so they knew what it was about going down the stretch this time, even though we did struggle to score runs, but our pitching was really good down the stretch, and guys were still playing really good baseball. But I don't know. I mean, there might have been in Cincinnati, like I said, we started 1-3 and got blown out the night before in Cincinnati. And I think the next day it was basically, I told the guys, it was, I don't care if it's Prince or Braun or whoever it was going to be, that we got to start making things happen offensively, get back to more, even though, because we could hit home runs obviously, and just playing more little ball hit and run and stuff. And I think one thing that turned that game around was I did put a hit and run on with Ryan Braun, and sure enough he puts it in play and finds a hole, a ground ball finds a hole, and all of a sudden everything started clicking offensively a little bit more to win a couple games there, and it got us back on track anyway, I think, to get back home after winning those last two games in Cincinnati, and then to win the next six out of seven to go to the playoffs. But more importantly, I think it was obviously the CCs and then the Mike Camerons and some of our veteran players, Prince and Braun, those guys are just great players. But the leadership those guys produced and it was just a special group of guys that, had gone through it. It was kind of almost what happened in 14 and 15 with the young players we had in the Royals. They had gotten to that point where they know they're good. They've accomplished things now. And we got so close, obviously 90 feet away in 2014 from mm-hmm. winning the World Series. And then they wanted it that much more the next year. And, then we ended up winning the World Series. Obviously that didn't happen in Milwaukee, but it was the same kind of young team, young, really good young players that had already gone through a little bit of the taste of September baseball.
When Ryan Braun hits that home run in 2008 in the eighth inning to give the Brewers a 3-1 lead, did it cross your mind at all that it was like a little bit like 87, that maybe the Rob Deere prequel part of it, maybe, but I don't know. Those are two just very seminal moments for Brewers fans. Was there any comparison in the moment in your mind?
I think at that moment, all I was thinking is about Braun just hit a game go ahead. I mean, a go ahead home run.
Of course.
I didn't think about 87 at that point. I was thinking about, okay, CeCe's got 115 pitches going in the ninth inning on 3 days rest. What's my next move if things start going a little haywire in the bottom of the ninth? So, yeah, but I mean, it was obviously, I mean, you look back on those moments. Just a few days earlier, Braun hit a walk-off grand slam. I think the score was 1-1 or something. And then the next night, I think Prince hits a walk-off home run. So many special things were happening that, you just had a feeling that, if we could just get those big boys to the plate one more time, somebody was going to hit a home run or do something. And sure enough, Ronnie did. And CeCe, slammed the door in the bottom of the ninth. Thank God, because I would have been crucified if he didn't. That's part of the gig.
Yeah. I know you were disappointed not to get the managerial job then in 2009, went to Ken Maka instead, but the Brewers do bring you back as hitting coach. Was that awkward at all? I mean, I don't want to like throw salt in the wound or kick, you know, but it's cool that you were able to stay with the organization, but I know also kind of a bummer that you weren't able to stay on in the managerial capacity.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, I ain't going to lie about it. It was very disappointing not getting the job, especially how things went down the stretch. I'm not saying obviously it was me, but, I mean, we did make it to the playoffs. Mm-hmm. It was obviously a tough time to be thrown in there in that way. And to do what the organization wanted was obviously to get to the playoffs and see what happens. And you know, we did have some bad luck against Philadelphia. It could have been a different series if maybe Ben Sheets didn't blow out and, can't even think of it.
Yeah, or Gallardo was healthy.
That freaking fouled off about 11 balls.
Oh, Brett Myers.
And then ended up walking. And then,
Brett Myers.
Brett Myers, yeah. He was probably the worst hitting pitcher in the league besides Ben Sheets. And he fouls off all these pitches. And then CC ended up walking him. And then, dang it. Center fielder for those guys.
Yeah, Victorino. Shane Victorino.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, Victorino. It's the grand slam. And Gallardo pitched a good game, and he would have hit a 3-run homer to put us up by 3 or 4 in that game. And the huge storm came in right when he hits the ball, you know, left field in Philadelphia ain't that far anyway. Mm-hmm. And he just crushes the ball in the left field, but the wind was blowing about 30 miles an hour for a quick little storm that popped up, and Burrell catches it right in the flowers in the field. So there were some things, you know, that were actually didn't go our way, but hey, that's the playoffs. I mean, we had some huge things go our way in 15 to catapult us to winning that World Series.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things you can always look back on in playoffs, the losing team and the winning team. Like, wow, if that didn't happen, we wouldn't have these rings right now, or if that would have happened, we could have the ring right now. So that's all part of the game.
Yeah. In 2015, like you mentioned, of course, that's with the Royals. They go to the World Series in 2014. You guys win it in 2015. I think Brewers fans, they felt like the managerial change was justified in the moment because of just how desperate Brewers fans and the Brewers were to get to the playoffs. But then, there is, I guess, an expected level of vindication for a guy like Ned Yost to then go to Kansas City, help rebuild that program, and then they win a World Series, and you're right there alongside him. I mean, that had to, not that you guys are down on the Brewers or anything, but that had to be kind of sweet to know that there was this one situation where you felt like you'd brought them to the precipice of something, didn't get a chance, Ned didn't get to stay on, you weren't kept as manager, and then you get to win another World Series anyway a few years later. That had to add to the sweetness of that moment a little bit, didn't it?
Well, I think, just getting back with Ned, I mean, Ned was very fortunate after I got fired from the Cubs, literally 2 hours after I was fired, on my walk home from the press conference being fired, Ned called me and wanted me to come over with Kansas City and be the third base coach, and obviously I accepted right away, and then we were together for 6 full seasons, and obviously went to one and won another one. So they're always satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you look back and say whatever.
Sure.
To this, I mean, I know Milwaukee will always be a special place in my heart, just because of coming up there, all the friends I've made, the players I've played with, the relationship I had with Doug Melvin and Mark Antanasio and Bud Selig and Bob Uecker, and you just create so many friendships and stuff that, the one thing about baseball is, one, you're in it to be fired, and
yes.
Two, and things are not always going to get, we all have bosses, and they make the decisions, and that's the way it is, but I think, no matter what happens, yeah, you're always disappointed that you didn't get this job, or you got fired, or whatever. But that's part of the industry, and that, unfortunately, those things happen, and they'll always continue to happen. I mean, So that is what it is. And I mean, there's still only one other team in baseball. I look at the box scores every day to find out how another team did, and it's the Milwaukee Brewers. I mean, I'm good friends with Craig Counsell. I'm just so happy he's having so much success. And, you know, Eddie Cedar is still there. And Bill Schroeder and those guys are announcing, and Bob's still there. Mm-hmm. It's still one team that I pull for on an everyday basis and look forward to seeing how they did. It was very fun to watch them in the playoffs and in some of the September baseball they got to play the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, you got 3 World Series rings. Where do you still have them? Where do you keep them? You got them out prominently, or are they just kind of boxed away somewhere?
I don't wear them. One, they're too big to wear, but I'm not much of a jewelry guy or anything like that. But no, they're just sitting in my closet underneath all my clothes. So I don't really put them out. Obviously, they're obviously, you know, bring back memories and they're a special moment. I'm not a big guy that wears them. Fortunately, I have actually 4 of them because the Cubs actually were nice enough to give me.
Oh, that's
one,
awesome.
For whatever I did there.
I was going to bring that up. Well, you laid the groundwork. I mean, 2 years manager, you laid the groundwork. That's great that they gave you a ring. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was a very professional deal, and the ownership and everything to even think about that. So that was really cool. I don't wear them. I've never been one to keep any memorabilia. I think I still have my first major league hit, and I think I kept a bat that I hit 3 home runs with. But as far as that goes, I don't really keep a whole lot of stuff. Some stuff from the 2004 World Series, champagne bottles and those kind of things you keep. But other than that, yeah, I'm not a big guy in wearing any of the rings. One, I think it just brings attention to yourself. if you're in a restaurant, somebody wants to look at it or see it, and then it becomes, one of those things. But I wouldn't know really which one to wear.
Yeah, right.
They're all beautiful rings, and over the years, they've just gotten bigger. The first one, the Yankees World Series ring from 98, probably the only somewhat wearable one. And then the other ones, the Red Sox and the Royals and Cubs, are so big. It's hard to even get your hand in your pocket. They're so big.
Yeah.
But they just sit in my closet underneath everything.
All right. Well, Dale Swaim, really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for taking a stroll down a couple different avenues of memory lane. And we appreciate it. Hopefully we can chat again sometime in the future.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that chat. 1987-2008, 2 very momentous years in Milwaukee Brewers history. And as I've said on past podcasts, not saying no to maybe going back and talking about other seasons in Brewers history. 1982 is the one that I'm sure everybody thinks about when they're thinking about Brewers history, but I'd love to go back and see 2011, love to chat about 1978, which is a pretty momentous occasion in Brewers history. We'll see if I can track down some people to chat about those times. Tom Hundercourt, of course, will be back in due time, and we'll chat with him as well, looking back at some of these occasions in Brewers history. Thanks for tuning into the Milwaukee Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. Again, my name is J.R. Radcliffe. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review, please. Those are huge. You got a lot of time, right? Not doing anything else right now. So leave us a rating and review. I really appreciate everybody who still listens to this. I know that it's not as fun. It just isn't. There's just not live baseball to talk about. There's not speculating about what's going to happen with the roster or the schedule coming up or where they stand or what's happening. We don't get to do that, and it stinks. This is the best we can do, and hopefully this provides a little bit of fun, a little bit of historical context to your day. And thanks again for tuning in. We will chat with you again next week. Bye-bye.